It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Central Time, we'll learn about the life of a Wisconsin legend, painter John Stuart Curry.
First, when the Social Security Program for Disabled Children began in 1974, it was a little-known effort that largely provided cash to families with severely physically disabled children. The aim was to assist parents who couldn't work as a result of their child's disability.
Today, new data shows that the program, known as SSI, has eclipsed traditional welfare programs to become the biggest source of monthly cash assistance for the nation's poorest families.
The disabilities covered have also been broadened to include things like attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, autism spectrum disorders, and depression. Advocates say that it is one of the last remaining programs that hasn't faced harsh cuts by the federal government, but others say it has simply replaced welfare since reforms in the mid-90s.
David Wittenberg is with us now. He's senior researcher at Mathematica Policy Research. David, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this important issue.
Well, before we break into the details, is the fact that this program has grown so much, eclipsing many other welfare programs, is this seen as a problem in our federal government?
It's hard to say if it's a problem. I think the basic question that's arising on all sides of the debate is SSI's changing role in the safety net, and clearly by the overview that you just provided, the Child SSI program is playing a much larger role relative to supports that were previously provided to low-income families, particularly the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program. And I think the reason why you're seeing so much spotlight on this issue is precisely because the Child SSI recipients have grown by approximately 50% from 880,000 youth to 1.3 million youth since 1997 in the absence of any eligibility changes for the program.
So when this started back before that, about 40 years ago, it was even smaller still. What did this program look like at the outset?
Well, at the outset, actually, it had started in 1974, and as Ed Berkowitz described in his book on the history of the Child SSI program, the eligibility requirements for the children were actually thought of as kind of an afterthought. And until the 1990s, the program remained to be quite small, well under 200,000, and it wasn't thought of as a major safety net program. And then there was a series of expansions, particularly through court cases and changes in the mental impairments listings that substantially increased the eligibility for children with disabilities in the 1990s. That was eventually curtailed somewhat in 1996.
But so the program has risen. Is part of the concern that this is happening, this growth is happening, we're doing this, but there hasn't been really a lot of policy thought put into, is this the most effective way to help the people in this way?
I think that is kind of precisely the question is a lot of this growth has occurred completely in the absence of policy changes. When I say a lot of this growth, I'm speaking specifically of the growth since 1997. And I should probably be very careful here because there was a large amount of growth following the Supreme Court decision for Brian Zebley in the early 1990s that substantially expanded and changed the eligibility definition for children with disabilities. And so there was a big period in this early 90s where there was an expansion. And then since 1997, there hasn't been any eligibility changes. And to put this into context, the program grew from approximately 200,000 youth in the early 90s to 800,000 youth in 1997. And from 1997 to 2013, we've seen another substantial growth, but there hasn't been any policy change. So I think it's important to really distinguish between those two periods and thinking about the program.
Sure. Well, something that happened around that time in the mid-90s, a big welfare reform, changes to eligibility to a lot of the more traditional programs we wrap up under the rubric welfare. There's a worry now from critics, I gather, that this is kind of a sneaky way to provide benefits that may have been lost then to more people now without the same guidelines.
I think that there is definitively a changing role in this safety net, and I think that this is sort of a hotly contested issue. So I think this really gets at the role of policies in serving low-income families. And following welfare reform, you had a major change in policies at the state level, where there was an increasing emphasis on work requirements and time limits generally through the TANF program for low-income families. And following that at that same time, the TANF caseloads dropped substantially. And so, in part, some of the growth you can argue with SSI is perfectly expected, and particularly given state incentives for serving low-income families, as well as families and youth incentives for obtaining benefits. And I think the one thing to be very careful here is sometimes people confuse incentives with frauds of whether or not people are quote unquote deserving. I think it's really important to take this picture that we're seeing in the changing safety net and say to yourself, okay, what is exactly going on? We certainly have this one broad set of programs that appear to be contracting, and people are looking for alternative supports. And some of those people may have been on those other programs in the absence of the child SSI program. And when you look at the incentives, I think that those incentives are really pointing more squarely at the child SSI program expanding.
Well, some of the reporting I've seen of the people involved in this program might be a parent with kids who could use some kind of federal help, and the kid might be on the borderline of an ADHD diagnosis, maybe yes, maybe no. The incentive from this program is get that diagnosis, get the medication, and then you are eligible. Not fraud, as you were saying, but maybe a perverse incentive.
Yeah, I think that there is a concern about perverse incentives, and I think that we can certainly say that there are challenges with potential incentives pointing at the child SSI program, but we don't know the precise issues that are driving the growth, because there are these variations, and there's particularly large variations at the state level, which makes sort of tracking this growth especially challenging. For example, in your own state, in Wisconsin, there's been a 25% growth in child SSI recipients from 17,500 to 23,000, whereas in Texas, and I should say that's from 1997 to 2013, in Texas, over that same period, you see a 300% growth rate in child SSI youth from 50,000 to 150,000 youth. So clearly there are some very big changes and very big differences going on across states. So I want to be very careful in distinguishing between we know what is going on and the actual incentives themselves, because I think that there's some additional complexities are going on beyond potentially the youth incentives and their families' incentives to apply for benefits.
Well, and trying to untangle all this down the road, it seems like the priority would be, okay, how do we meet the needs of the families we want to meet the needs of without throwing money in the wrong directions and making sure that the future needs of the kids with disabilities are being met? What's the next step? How do you start getting there?
Yeah, I think that you phrased that quite well, which is, and if I could use some of the terminology, is how do you deal with some of the very positive effects of the child SSI's program in alleviating poverty? The child SSI check comprises half of the family's income, and so we should keep in mind that the youth that are in these families receiving SSI are coming from very low-income families, and it's often their only source of support. But we have to balance it with these incentives, and I think it's really thinking about what the investment is in these children. So it is, can we develop alternative incentives rather than focusing solely on their disability, focusing much more on their ability and their potential for working in education, and design a set of supports that address this, maybe the very necessary short-term poverty needs of the family, but also consider what are the long-term implications for the child and the child's family in terms of providing SSI supports. And this gets to an issue they haven't really talked too much about the long-term implications of child SSI benefit receipt.
Before we let you go, this is a complicated problem. There are a lot of competing priorities at the federal level. Is anybody starting to make a move to tackle this and make some of the changes you're looking for there?
Well, I'm happy to say that there have been some moves to test initiatives such as the youth transition demonstration that the Social Security has funded and the promoting readiness for SSI recipients, which are demonstrations that are still in the field that provide employment-based supports to child SSI recipients to promote employment outcomes. But some of the information from those interventions have actually suggested some positive impacts, suggesting that particularly with the youth transition demonstration, that it might be that there might be positive implications providing employment supports to promote employment outcomes. But there hasn't been a fuller scale test of testing alternative benefit tracks to youth with disabilities. And I think that in the absence of that evidence, it's hard to know really what works and how best to serve these youth.
David, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
That was David Wittenberg. He's senior researcher at Mathematica Policy Research. We've been talking about new data showing that Social Security for children with disabilities has eclipsed traditional welfare programs to become really the biggest source of monthly cash assistance for the nation's poorest families. Time for Wisconsin Legends, where we take a look at some of the most noteworthy people who at some point called Wisconsin their home.
Today we're talking about famed regionalist artist John Stewart Curry. As a young painter, he came to Madison in 1936 to become the nation's first artist in residence at an American university, and he fell in love with Wisconsin.
He channeled that love into sweeping paintings of Wisconsin landscapes, many of which have now been curated into a new exhibit at the Museum of Wisconsin Art. It's called John Stewart Curry at Home in Wisconsin.
Joining us now to talk about Curry's life and to tell us about the new exhibit is Graham Reed, Director of Collections and Exhibitions at the Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend. Graham, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Well, it would be great to take complete credit for Curry here in Wisconsin, but he wasn't actually from Wisconsin. Can you talk us about tell us about what his early life was like before he got to our state?
Well, Curry actually grew up on a farm just outside Donovan in Kansas and was born there in 1897. But he went to he was in Kansas, then he was in New York, and he was in Westport, Connecticut. And in 1936, he really kind of got an offer that he could not refuse. I think he was basically unhappy on the East Coast and I think was yearning to get back to the Midwest. And then when Dean Chris Christensen of the College of Agriculture at UW-Madison called him with an offer that Curry couldn't refuse. And so basically it was to be the first artist in residence at an American university. It was $4,000 a year, custom-made studio, no teaching requirements. But the kind of you could say basically his charge was to be a force for rural culture within the state. And it was very much part of what you would call the Wisconsin idea, and that was that there should be a much closer relationship between the Ivory Tower, UW-Madison, the academic side of the state, and also the rural side of the state, which was, you know, predominantly rural, predominantly agriculture. And I think what was groundbreaking was that even though kind of biochemistry and agriculture obviously seemingly had a much more direct relationship, or certainly had a closer and more practical relationship than the arts, Chris Christensen firmly believed that the arts and culture were very much part of an education, and that Curry was the man to do that. He was going to work closely with rural artists throughout the state and encourage them to pursue their vocation, even though that may not have been their actual occupation.
Well, it's amazing that the first artist in residence in the country was not in an art school, but in the UW's agriculture school. And he's inventing this job in a way. How did he put this artist in residence for the Ag College into practice?
Well, they built him a studio, which was actually paid for by the state. He was kind of charged with doing his own work, interacting with students, but then very much getting out into the rural parts of the state and bringing artists to Madison. And there's a wonderful story that I read about, he was actually a miner from Illinois, of all places, Vashel Davis, who sent some drawings to Curry and pretty much on a whim, and I'm sure he expected to hear nothing in reply, but Curry saw the drawings, liked them, and invited this miner from El Dorado, Illinois, to come there. And so I'm sure this miner was just pinching himself as he's sitting there in Curry's studio working on his work, while Curry is across the other side of the room working on his work. And, you know, I think temperamentally, I think Curry was the ideal person for this position, because when Curry first went to art school at the Kansas City Art Institute, I think he was very much perceived and treated as an outsider. I think he was kind of regarded as, well, here's this farm boy, you know, what's he doing here? So I think, you know, Curry, I think through that experience, kind of knew what it felt to be kind of from the outside looking in on the art world. And so I think that very much informed his attitude when he was working with the rural artists in the state, to say, I know what it's like to be kind of perceived as being outside of the art world, and I'm going to help welcome you into the art world. And so I think that was a huge part of why Curry was so successful at Madison.
Well, can you tell us about some of the pieces of art that may have come out of his time at the university?
Well, we've actually got a lot of things in the exhibition that have never been either shown publicly before or haven't been together in decades. And one of the things that I think really exemplifies Curry's role within the kind of Wisconsin idea and the life of the university was in 1941, he was commissioned to do a series of murals for the biochemistry department. And we have the original full-scale drawings of the central panel. And this features people like Stephen Babcock, Elmer McCollum, E.B. Hart. I mean, these were all people, scientists at the university, who came up with things like vitamin A, the single grain experiment. I mean, these were people who had a major, major impact on life in Wisconsin. And so here's Curry doing those. We have four of the five drawings that Curry did for the 1941 Badger Yearbook, which was dedicated by the students to Curry. And then we have five fantastic football images, one being the only surviving football painting that Curry ever did. But there are four drawings that go along with this, two which relate specifically to two players in the painting, and then two sketches that are much more kind of sophisticated renderings of the painting. We have the three large paintings that Curry did in 1941, First National Bank, which are now owned by the Chazen Museum, the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art, and the Milwaukee Art Museum. These three large paintings haven't been together in decades. Let's see, what else do we have? We also have probably one of the most iconic paintings, not just, I think, in Curry's career, but also in really 20th century American art, and that is the painting Our Good Earth, which he did in 1941-42, and which was actually used as a promotional image for war bonds during the Second World War. And it's kind of a farmer standing, you know, defiantly in his field with his two children by his side, clutching three strands of grain. And you can really look at the painting in two ways. One, you can look at it as being Curry painting basically his connection to the landscape and his knowledge of farming and farmers that he would have gleaned as he went around the state. But you can also look at it very much from the point of view as, this was the home front. This is the heartland. It's the Midwest. This is what the Second World War, in many respects, was being fought for. This is the home front. You're fighting for basically the motherland. And so it's a tremendously powerful image, not only from Curry's direct experience within the state, but really on a larger national context of what the war was being fought for. So we've got things that As I say, I've never been shown publicly before. We also have his last mural that was done in 1946 for a livestock barn at Wisconsin State Fair Park. And fortunately, this was rescued by a gentleman called Elmer Schultz, because this thing otherwise would have ended up in a dumpster.
Wow. Graham, it sounds like a great exhibit. Thank you so much for sharing his work with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for calling.
That was Graham Reed. He's the Director of Collections and Exhibitions at the Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend. He's the curator of the exhibit we've been talking about, John Stuart Curry, at Home in Wisconsin. First, we take a look at a new controversial study on salt consumption.
The large international study indicated that the amount of salt that most people eat is okay. It also showed that eating too little salt in your diet is almost as unhealthy as eating too much. But these findings contradict a lot of other research on salt, including another new study showing that too much sodium contributes to over a million deaths a year.
Here to help us sort out the salt wars, we have Dr. Patrick Remington. He's a professor in the Department of Population Health Sciences in the School of Medicine and Public Health at UW-Madison. Dr. Remington, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be here. Thanks.
Well, we read the papers. We don't always know what to make of all this dueling data. Let's look at that one that seemed to say and was headlined often, hey, we're mostly doing okay when it comes to salt, and be careful, you could actually eat too little salt. What did you make of that?
Well, it was a large study that looked at 17 countries around the world and measured sodium once a day. And it found that when you look at people who are consuming a lot of salt, that there's a relationship. The more salt within that group consumed, the more high blood pressure, the more heart disease, and the more early deaths. Even in the middle group of salt consumers, there's a relationship. They suggest, there's a suggestion, though, in people eating a little bit of salt, and that would be considered a low-salt diet in this country, the relationship may not be there. In fact, maybe that's worse than the group that is in the middle section.
And do you buy that, the idea that we maybe are going too low when we go on a low-salt diet?
Well, the problem with this study and many other studies that use epidemiologic methods is that they observed a population and they studied free-living individuals. And there could be other reasons that people are consuming just a little bit of salt. An obvious one is maybe their doctor told them to do that because they had a medical problem. And although there are statistical and methodologic ways of controlling for this problem, it still could be present. So I think the best take-home message from this research is that too much salt is definitely bad for you. This study reaffirmed that, as did another study published in the New England Journal. But that when you get down to the low levels of salt, we're talking about really a low-salt diet, no added salt, and only eating low-salt foods, that may not be as good as we thought it was.
But the fact is, if you don't already know that you're in that low-salt group, you're not going to accidentally have that low-salt diet. Is that right?
Without a doubt. The average American eats about 3 to 4 grams of sodium per day. A low-sodium diet is 1.5. So if you're down to 1.5 grams a day, you will be consciously avoiding salt in prepared foods and processed meats and pizza and soups and things like that.
And you mentioned the average amount. How many of us are eating above that average amount to where we're just plain, nobody's arguing, we're eating too much salt?
Well, the average American eating 3 or 4 grams of salt has more salt in the diet than is recommended. Mm. So I think, you know, these studies don't change the recommendations, which are to cut back on the amount of salt you eat, to avoid adding salt, and to look for salt in foods that you buy to make sure that they're either low in salt or certainly not high in salt.
Right. So it's not just when we reach for the salt shaker that we're getting the salt. A lot of our food, you're saying, already has salt in it.
Well, it turns out that about 90% of the sodium that we get in our daily diet comes from the foods typically that are processed. Obviously, if you put together your own, if you make your own bread or make your own soups, you know exactly how much salt is in there. There isn't salt in vegetables or fruits. So any salt that ends up in food is put in, and you just don't know what food processors and restaurants and other people who prepare your food are putting in your food. You can read the label, but reading labels is complicated. You have to think about serving size and other things.
Why is there so much salt in our packaged food and our restaurant food? Do we have an idea of why it's there?
Well, it is. I don't know why salty food tastes better, mm-hmm. but it tends
but it
to. But it does. You can have a no-salt soup, and if there's any fat in that soup, that fat tastes almost rancid. But you add 2 or 3 teaspoons of salt, and it gives it a bolder, better flavor. You can spice foods with vinegar and pepper and other spices don't contain salt, and they can bring flavor to foods without having to add sodium. But it is clear that when you taste a food item, either pizza, some breads, and certainly processed meats, they taste the way they do because they're high in salt.
Let's get into the consequences a little more, the studies that led us to have this conversation, one of them pointing toward 1 million deaths every year, high sodium consumption. What specific health problems do we have when we eat too much salt over a long period of time?
Well, it's like a chain of events that begins. Salt does increase the risk of developing high blood pressure. High blood pressure is a risk for heart disease. It makes the heart work harder than it should. It's a risk for stroke. It can increase the chance of bleeding in the brain and having a stroke or dying from a stroke. And those things then lead to early deaths or certainly a lot of disease and morbidity and lower quality of life. So we really think about sodium as really the first step in a chain of events that leads to high blood pressure, and then it's absolutely established that high blood pressure is a serious risk factor for stroke and cardiovascular disease, and those lead to literally millions of years of life lost in society. So it's one of the risk factors. It's modifiable. You can change your diet and begin to find foods that are just as tasty but have lower amounts of salt.
You're in the public health profession. Does that chain you just described, salt leads to the blood pressure, leads to the other consequences, does that make it hard to sell people? It's not quite as simple as salt kills you. You know, this isn't poisonous tomorrow. Does it make it hard to sell that message?
Well, it not only makes it hard to sell that message, but salt, as we pointed out, tastes good. That in some cheeses and some processed meats and breads have salt that actually adds flavor that you don't really appreciate it, that it's salty, but you find it flavorful. So not only is the benefit from cutting back on salt delayed years and even decades, but that you're in effect giving something up. So clearly, if you change the norms and what is considered usual, over time, then in families, kids will be used to less salt. And what you find is as people begin to eat a low-salt diet, when you go out to dinner and you have a bowl of soup and it's salty, you'll actually comment that there's too much salt. You'll go home, you'll find yourself thirsty. And then you will have changed what your in a way your salt thermostat is telling you.
We have salt wars in my house. Sometimes when I make soup, I do it with very little salt, and my wife adds a lot of salt. I'm trying to meet her halfway sometimes. How do we start changing our salt thermostat? How do we do that nationwide?
Well, I think one other thing that this study did show was that when you get down to the low sodium level, it turns out that another chemical in our diet called potassium is really important. So when you are a low sodium consumer, if you're also not getting enough potassium, that can be a problem. So what you actually want to do is cut back on salt, but at the same time, think about ways of adding potassium to your diet. Bananas are the most obvious source of potassium, but green leafy vegetables, avocados, and a lot of fruits and vegetables, fish, salmon, for example, is high in potassium. So if you increase the potassium, then you don't need, in effect, to decrease the sodium as much. So you can, in a way, have your potassium and not have to cut back as much on salt.
So a little less salt, a little less sodium, a little more potassium, and we can kind of meet it halfway there.
And these studies clearly showed that the highest risk population was those groups with low sodium consumption and low potassium. So if you're going to do anything, add more foods that are healthy, more fresh fruits and vegetables that are high in potassium, and then the sodium equation becomes less important.
If you had to pick one starting point for kind of the point of entry, our individual tastes, the food industry, the medical profession, who needs to get the ball rolling on salt?
I'd say all of the above. clearly, the food industry needs to be told by consumers. Food industry doesn't just do things. They meet consumer demand. So as consumers begin to demand foods that are lower in sodium, as evidenced by the label, then the producers, the manufacturers will respond. So I think be aware of the issue that sodium is an important potential health risk, that too much salt can lead to disease. And then as you change your tastes, not by taking things away necessarily, but adding other spices, you'll increase the demand for those foods and manufacturers will produce them.
Talking to Dr. Patrick Remington about one new study that questions some of the conventional wisdom, saying everybody needs to cut salt from their diets, and that came along with a couple other studies at the same time offering contradictions to that.
And we're taking your calls on this. Well, how much salt do you eat? What do you try to do to cut your salt intake? And what kind of diet do you follow to be healthy? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your salt questions. And you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. We continue our conversation now with Dr. Patrick Remington about how much salt we should or shouldn't consume.
And we're taking your calls. How do you limit salt in your diet? Do you limit salt in your diet in any way, shape, or form? Is it something you haven't thought of, or is it something you've started reading labels to find? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@wpr.org. We'll go right to a caller. We've got Mike on the line in Appleton. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, I wonder, I have a salt addiction. I'm concerned. My dad had supposedly had TIA problems, many strokes. Am I susceptible to that if my blood pressure is always perfect? That's one question. Light salt, is that an option to reduce sodium? And also salt substitutes. I'm wondering what to look for.
Mike, thanks for the call. I'm guessing, regardless of family history, if Mike's saying he's a salt addict, a sodium addict, Pat, you would say he should cut back.
Well, I'm not sure salt fits the definition for addiction, not like heroin and other substances. But you do feel like it's hard sometimes to cut back. You have such a taste for high salt. So I think the best advice is to try and improve the taste of food with things other than salt. You do have light salt. Those are salt substitutes. They replace the sodium, which turns out to be the bad chemical, with potassium, which is good. But I think rather than trying to, titrate your level of potassium and sodium by shaking salt on the food, it's better to look for potassium in natural fruits and vegetables and basically eat a varied diet and try and avoid shaking salt on any food. There's plenty of salt and sodium in the foods that we get through manufacturers, and that should be sufficient. Now, he mentioned that it may have a family history of stroke or transient ischemic attacks. I think we're all at risk, really, of cardiovascular disease. There are very few people who can say that I'm basically immune from the effects of sodium. So about one-third of the population has high blood pressure. If you get to be 65 or 70 years of age, it's two-thirds. So virtually everybody is susceptible to high blood pressure and then the diseases like heart disease and stroke.
You know, before we get back to callers at 800-642-1234, you've been on the Ideas Network a lot of times talking about different health topics. And when it comes to diet, it seems like we're scurrying from one thing to another. Too much salt? No. Too little salt? Too much fat? No. Eat more fat. Is there a way we could kind of take all that and build a better way of eating?
It's a great comment that as Americans, or maybe it's the research enterprise, we tend to reduce, we like to reduce our diet to its components, not just to, foods, but to the chemicals within the foods. So it's now trans fats and sodium and, you know, different dietary constituents. What we really should do is look at a holistic way. Look at populations that live a long, healthy life and eat varied foods, like the Mediterranean population. The Mediterranean diet is actually not low in fat. It's high in liquid fats and olive oil and other liquid oils. It also is has dairy, but it has low-fat dairy, things like yogurt. And the most important thing is it's built on a foundation of active living, so that a diet when people are sedentary is different than a diet when you're very active and burning calories. So, again, I get back to pretty simple advice. Stay active and eat more of healthy foods and avoid some of the unhealthy things like added salt.
Well, and added salt often comes with the added fat and other things like that in packaged food. So is there a tip there? You mentioned when we make our own food, we tend to put less salt in it.
Well, I think progress over the 1960s, the answer was TV dinners, that, you know, we'd all be better off when you come home and you just can take the dinner out of the freezer and have a meal for your entire family. It turns out that when you prepare your own food, research has demonstrated convincingly that people who prepare their own food have healthier diets and live longer, better lives. Now, it takes time to prepare your own food, but you're better for it. That processed foods tend to be less healthy, but as a smart shopper, you can look at the ingredients, and I'm sure that you can find foods that are as healthy, but it's a little harder to find, and they may be higher priced than you're willing to pay.
Well, I'm so suggestible. Unfortunately, I really want a TV dinner now. Thanks.
Wouldn't that be good?
but I won't. We'll go back to our callers now. We've got Beth on the line in Burlington. Beth, hi.
Hi. I just had a question. You know, you guys are talking about low salt diets, and you're suggesting adding potassium in, you know, to kind of counter effect the low salt. What do you do when you need to have a low salt and low potassium diet? What would you suggest then?
Well, that's the research actually looked at people who have low salt, low sodium, and low potassium, and that makes there is a question in the research whether that may not be as good as having a little more sodium. So I'm not sure exactly the reasons for having to cut down on potassium, I would say that avoid adding sodium or potassium, but looking for foods that come naturally with potassium. But there are some people that need to cut down on potassium and avoid even dietary sources, and I think I'd follow the advice of whatever healthcare provider gave you that advice.
I imagine there's a lot of people out there. Well, heck, I don't know how much salt I eat. How do we know if we're in the category of people who consume too much salt?
I have to be honest. In preparing for this interview, I had to look up what 2 grams of sodium is. First of all, it never comes as sodium. It comes as sodium chloride. And sodium chloride is about 40% salt is about 40% sodium and about 60% chloride. So when you have a level teaspoon of salt, you're getting about 2.5 grams of sodium. And if you added that to food, that puts you right where you should be, the total amount of sodium you should have in a day. It's only 1 teaspoon. Most people eat 2 full teaspoons of sodium in a day. That's about 4 to 5 grams.
And if we're eating already salty food, I got to say, I have a limited tolerance for eating salt. And I see people salting, say, French fries at a fast food restaurant. And yeah, I'm there at the fast food restaurant eating plenty of sodium myself. But if we're adding extra salt to this already salty food, what kind of range is that putting us in?
Oh, it's easy to get. There are some individuals that consume 8, 10 or more grams of sodium. And there's no question that that puts a stress on the kidneys, that significantly increases the risk of high blood pressure. And let me point out that even though these studies are debating the health benefits of low sodium diets, and that is still a debate. There's no debate on whether high-sodium diets are associated with increased risk of high blood pressure, stroke, heart disease, and early death. There's all the study, all the research has consistently shown that over time.
Now, doctors, I assume any doctor we talk to is going to be more or less on board with what you're saying. We go to our family doctor or whatever. They're not confused. They're going to want us to cut back on our salt a little for the most part.
Yeah, and again, it depends whether you have hypertension or not, whether you have high blood pressure. That may be – so the advice may be different whether you're currently under treatment by a physician. But I think the general advice is avoid adding salt and look for fresh fruits and vegetables which are high in potassium. And also avoid processed foods that are high in sodium. And that should provide you with a healthy diet and on a foundation of physical activity, you'll do well.
And have I seen that health organizations are starting to have been lowering the bar over the years? What we used to consider an acceptable amount of salt is now viewed as too high based on more recent research?
The research, again, shows that as a country, the U.S. Is up at about twice the level of the recommended level. If you look on a food label, you'll see about 2.5 grams of sodium is recommended. But the American Heart Association and other organizations recommend about 1.5 grams. So I think you should be at or below the recommended daily allowance. And you can, when you buy any food, you can look at the amount, look at the percent, and as you start adding that up, stay below 100% of the 2.5 grams a day.
Okay. That's a good recommendation for people looking to make sense of that. As a public health guy, are we catching on in the public when it comes to salt?
Well, that has been slow. There's been progress in other areas. Clearly, cigarette smoking, we've made significant progress. People have cut back on the amount of fat in the diet. But the salt seems to be one that's harder to change. And we continue to see high rates of high blood pressure. About a third of the population still has high blood pressure. And a lot of that could be prevented through better diets.
We'll leave it there. Dr. Remington, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Patrick Remington. He's a professor in the Department of Population Health Sciences in the School of Medicine and Public Health at UW-Madison.